Okay, questions? Okay, homework four, key is posted. I also had some requests that I post versions of the prior exams without all the answers on them. I have done that for 2009 and 2010. Homework five key will be posted immediately after class. So as soon as I get back to my office and hook up to the internet again. Let's see, was there anything else I was going to say? I think that sums it up nicely. Questions? Okay. Well, we were talking about properties of variances, and these properties of variances are extremely important to us when it comes to making inference. So again, a variance is an expectation. We can use the linearity of expectation, and that's the idea that the expectation of a sum is the sum of the expectations. But with variances, we have to take into account that it's a little bit more complicated than just the expectation of the squared value. It's the expectation of the squared difference from the mean. And so we have to be more careful as we use these properties, and we have to think much more carefully about whether our data is independent or not. So I showed you last time that if all you're doing is a simple transformation of your data, then if I multiply my measurement by some constant and I add some constant, the variance is affected only by the number that you multiply by. Okay, so if you take a squared times the variance of x, this is, of course, very, very important. Lots of times we do modify our measurements, and you'd like to know that changing your scales from feet to centimeters or degrees Celsius to degrees Fahrenheit, that we have predictable ways that the expectations and variances are affected. But many times when you are reading the literature, the scientific literature, there will be data that is presented that is almost the answer to the question you wanted. Of course, if you're the referee for that article, it's really easy. You reject the paper until they put the analysis you want in there. Usually, you also request that all of your opinions be given more emphasis than the opinions of the authors. But that's not a good practice. It just seems to be the rule. But the idea that you might ask for the analyses to be placed there, it all happens. But what do you do when they don't give them to you? Well, often we get statistics within strata, and then what we want to do is either do an adjusted analysis, so we will combine the stratum-specific estimates in some way to come up with a sort of substitute adjusted analysis, or we are interested in testing for interactions. So we would like to see whether there is a statistically significant difference between men and women. But they gave you the statistics for men and women, but never gave you the test of the interaction. And this is where we can use these ideas. If the strata are completely independent of each other, well, then our correlation is zero, and the variance of the sum or the variance of the difference is just the sum of the variances. And this is because the variance of x minus y is really the variance of x plus negative 1 times y, right? And then we square things that we multiply by. So that negative sign goes away on the variance, but it doesn't over here on this covariance, or where the correlation is. And that's where we gain some advantage. The other thing that we look at on this is we see the advantage of doing crossover studies, right? The idea that somebody you might test them while they are doing transcendental meditation and measure their blood pressure, and then you test them while they are exercising for the same amount of time and measure their blood pressure. My belief is that a major effect of exercise is just that you aren't doing work, and so transcendental meditation is my control group. If we look at that, what we see is the variance of the differences of two measurements made on the same subject will be less because we expect their measurements to be positively correlated. So this is where we gain precision in studies. But you see what happens if I make repeat measurements on the same subject and add them all together. And then if I don't account for the fact that it's correlated observations, my true variance is larger. So if I had independent subjects and I added them two together, my variance would just be the variance of X plus the variance of Y. But if I take two correlated observations, so rather than taking me and somebody else to measure blood pressure, you just measured blood pressure on me twice. There is more variability as you take that average than there would have been if you'd taken two different subjects. So this was the point of homework three where I said, hey, you know, you really need to always think about when you have repeat measurements on subjects because the correlation between those repeat measurements is going to mess up our estimates of the variability. And this is it. This is the only formula that you need to know. And you can answer all of these questions. Do you actually need to know this formula? Well, you need to understand the basic concepts here. In your scientific papers, usually your strata will be independent, but not always. If they have done a crossover study and they have matched observations, then there's usually not enough information for you to do your statistics because you don't know the correlation. Okay, so again, sums of independent variables, we can drop off those terms with the correlation. So where does this come into? Well, most of what we're doing is we're taking means of random variables. That's what we're using most often to test for associations. So what we do is we sample independent measurements from a population in which the average value in the population is mu, the variance in the population is sigma squared. Then, across a large number of replicated studies, the average sample mean will be mu. Double expectation formula, what this is called. And then the variance of the sample mean will be sigma squared over n. We're going to get more and more precision about estimating the population mean by taking the average of lots of observations. And these results come exactly from those formulas that I just showed. If the measurements are not independent, then the proceeding does not hold. So then the question is, somebody has done a bad analysis. You've looked in the literature, and somebody has done an analysis in which they made repeated measurements on the same subjects, and they said, but I just did the t-test. The question is, are their results wrong? That's an easy one to answer. Yes, they are wrong. Which direction are they wrong? And we can answer that question pretty well. Which direction are they wrong? So, if there are positively correlated measurements, then as I take a group's sample mean, then the variability of the sample mean with the correlated observations is bigger than is the variability if I had all independent data. So just think this through, right? If I have 100 people, there are 100 independent people. I have more information about the population mean than if I have 10 people that I take 10 measurements on. Let's take it to its extreme. If I want to know what the population average height is, how many of you would be very impressed when I told you I had 100 measurements, but they were 10 measurements of the height of 10 people? That's not very much information. That correlation is way too high. I'm going to get very close to the same measurement every time I measure them. Okay, so the variability of that sample mean computed from 10 subjects with 10 measurements each, that variability should behave more like just having one measurement on 10 subjects than like having one measurement on 100 subjects, right? So we've overstated our statistical information. We've overstated our effective sample size. So if I'm taking a group, and in that group I have positively correlated data on the same subjects, then if I don't account for correlation, I'm pretending that I have more precision than I do. That leads to anti-conservative inference. I know less than I thought I did. Now, what if I had negatively correlated measurements in the group? Well, then I actually have more precision than I had when I did it. Now, it's an interesting question, of course. How do you get negatively correlated data? So a really good example of negatively correlated observations is if you're trying to measure the gas consumption of your car, and every time you make a mistake and you don't quite fill up your tank all the way one time, the next time will be biased in the opposite direction. So that'll be negatively correlated data due to that mistake. I like to make up other times that data is negatively correlated. Like, if I don't get very much sleep tonight, then tomorrow night I'll get to sleep longer. So the amount of sleep I get in one night is negatively correlated with the amount of sleep I get the next night. And that's all well and good for within me. You know, that if you looked at the correlated between times. But the trouble is, some of you out there sleep 8 hours a night, and so when you don't get as much sleep, 6 hours, then you have to sleep 10 hours the next night. But of course, I sleep 20 hours a night, and so when I don't get very much sleep, that's 18 hours, and so the next night I have to sleep 22 hours. And what it ends up is, when we look across people, it's still positive and correlated. Where even if, you know, within a person, there's a negative correlation. The other place this actually shows up is in toxicology experiments. It's often done on looking at teratogenicity, so the fact of whether drugs would cause birth defects, and it's done in rats. And we have several rats in a litter. And you might look at the fact that one rat that was bigger than the others, if one of them is bigger than the others, it's taking nutrition away from the others, so that there's negative correlation between rats in a litter. But again, the dam effect, the effect of the mother, just some mothers provide more nutrition than others, that makes more of a difference. So positive correlation is what we see most often when repeated measurements. So that's the one that we think about the most. I guess I should point out one other aspect that we haven't really gotten to is back to the crossover design. When we have a crossover design, now when we take the means within correlated observations, we're taking them across groups. So the correlated observations, one's in the Tylenol group, one's in the aspirin group. One's in the exercise group, one's in the transcendental meditation group. In those cases, if we fail to adjust for the correlation, we have actually conservative inference. So you have to think. Some people will just say, if you have correlated data, then your answer is wrong, and it's in the wrong anti-conservative direction. It's in the idea of pretending you have more information than you do. But that's not true. If the subjects are in different groups at different times, you gain more precision by looking at matched observations. And so we'll come back to that a lot. These are simple rules that we can look at. Okay. Standard errors of statistics, we usually find it easier to use the square root of variances because variance is in squared units. Standard errors are the square root of the variance of a statistic. Somebody recently told me if a book defines standard errors in a screwier fashion, I think that book was wrong. But this is how we use the word standard error, the square root of the variance of a statistic. And the major motivation for this nomenclature is to distinguish it from the standard deviation of the population versus what would happen if we repeated experiments many times. Standard errors must be derived from variances. So we compute standard errors by first finding the sampling variance of the statistic and When we transform or combine statistics, we convert standard errors to variances, then we use the properties of variances, usually adding them, and then we take the square root again, convert it back to a standard error. Knowing the bias and standard error of statistics to estimate the sample distribution, well, we can use that Chebyshev inequality that says that 89% of a population must be within 3 standard deviations of its mean. So for any given statistic, we would expect the statistic to be within 3 standard errors of its mean in at least 89% of all studies. We like to be more precise than this, but this is always true. We like to be to use results that are based on asymptotic theory. And the word asymptotic just means this is the approximation that as your sample size gets larger and larger and larger, this approximation gets better and better and better. Okay? So when we don't know the exact sampling distribution, or when it's just too difficult to compute, then we can use theoretical results to allow statistical inference. Most of this is based on some form of a central limit theorem for the distribution of a sum or arithmetic mean. So as we add numbers together, then the distribution of that sum tends to look like a normal distribution. So the central limit theorem. If I have independent and identically distributed data where each observation has expectation mu, and the variance in the population is sigma squared, and that's a finite variance, these are the only requirements, then for a large sample size, the sample mean is approximately normally distributed with mean mu and variance sigma squared over n. And what I like to point out is we've already talked about how the sample mean should have expectation mu and should have variance sigma squared over n. So all the central limit theorem tells me is it's the normal distribution with that mean and variance. For example, in the binomial distribution, the binomial random variables are just the sum of n independent, identically distributed Bernoulli variables. If you flip a coin 10 times and you count the number of heads, that's a binomial random variable. But I can look upon that as you did 10 experiments. You flipped a coin one time. And then I counted those results that were either 0 or 1. So it was the sum of those 0 or 1s. And in this idea that you have x is just the sum of those independent repetitions of the experiment, then we would expect that as the sample size gets large, that we should have a normal distribution. So we apply the central limit theorem. This is the very first central limit theorem that was discovered, was this concept that the sample mean, so the sample proportion, is approximately normally distributed with mean p, variance p times 1 minus p over n. And then, based on the properties of the normal, I could say that x itself, the sum, is approximately normally distributed with mean np and variance np times 1 minus p. And instead of using the more complicated formula, the binomial, we can then look it up in a table in the back of the book. How large is large? This is a sucker's game. Okay? And it's a very natural game, but the key point is you tell me the sample size, and I'll tell you the value of p that is not yet good enough for this to be. You tell me that you have 7 billion observations, and I'll tell you that, yes, but if p is 1 over 10 to the 100, you don't have a large enough sample size yet for the normal approximation to hold. So one rule of thumb that we often use is that n times p is greater than 5, and n times 1 minus p is greater than 5. It does all right. Does all right. And you can talk about not having too many outliers. We're making certain that we have enough events observed, or that we should have had enough events observed.
We don't want to go with a data set where we expected to observe zero events and then claim that we had it normally distributed. So this is just something that you'll find people using a lot. So the definition of large sample size will be dependent upon the original distribution. Distributions with heavy tails require larger sample sizes for a good approximation. But it's often surprising how small large is. A sample size of 30 to 40 is generally sufficient for most data sets. And though we have gotten better at it now, when statisticians experiment, we generate random data on a computer. And we're pretty good at generating uniformly distributed data, so a number that's between 0 and 1 with equal probability. And what we used to do a long time ago to generate a normal random variable is you just generate 10 of those and you take the average. So that was saying, wait, a sample size of 10 was good enough to look approximately normal. We've got better methods now. This paper at the bottom, when we wrote this for a while, we were referring to it in defense of the mean. You know, it's saying people worry about the central limit theorem not holding. In fact, it holds quite well. And this was done in health services data. And health services data, it's quite often the case that most people have no healthcare costs in a given year, and then some people have thousands and thousands of dollars, so extremely skewed data. And this just explores how well the sample mean and linear regression and the t-test all behave with that highly skewed data. Look at a couple examples here. Let's start off with normally distributed data. Okay, so the very first picture that I show up there in the left upper left-hand corner is the true density. That's the true density I get from a formula. And what I did is I went through and I simulated data, and sure enough, that data looks like it has a normally distributed sample mean. Sample mean of one observation is just the observation itself. And the key point is, as I get more and more, so I go to a sample size of 5, 10, 20, or 40, it's staying normally distributed, but just getting narrower, more concentrated about the true population mean. This is no surprise. The sum of normally distributed random variables, say the sum of independent normally distributed random variables, is normal, or the sum of multivariately distributed normal random variables is normal, but there's some other categories in there. What about if I start with uniformly distributed data? Data that is between 0 and 1 with equal probability on each number. So the density is just a flat line. If I just sample one of them, sure enough, I get that flat line. As I increase my sample size to 5 and take the average, rather than having the flat line anymore, it's now more of a bell-shaped curve centered at 0.5, which is the average. Get a sample size of 10, 20, 40, it's normally distributed. Okay. Of course, the uniform distribution has lighter tails than does the normal distribution. So we get, to some extent, a nicer distribution with the uniform in some respects. What about, yes? So it's the sample mean of a sample size of 1, okay, or sample mean of a sample size of 5. Okay, but I did lots and lots of experiments. Did 1,000, 10,000, something like that, maybe 100,000 experiments. I drew the histogram. Now, exponential data is a decreasing density. It starts at 0. The highest probability is something at 0, and then it just levels off to infinity. There's always a thing. And again, this exponential distribution was the one with the memorylessness property. If you have something that comes from an exponential distribution and it has already survived a million years, the probability of it surviving another million years is exactly the same as if it was newborn. So not a very realistic in most scientific situations. And when I only get one observation and take the mean of that one observation, it looks like the exponential distribution. As I take sample sizes of 5, take the mean, it's starting to look more normal, but it's still skewed. at 10. You can still see a little bit of the skewed, but that probability of it being off in those tails is very, very small. And then so on as we get to sample size of 40. Looks quite good for it. Yes?
If the top left is the true density, why would you want it to look, I guess I'm missing the main point, why would you want it to look normal? Like, wouldn't you want it to, your simulation to look like your true density?
Well, the data will always look like that density. And the question is why would I want it to look like the normal distribution? Well, I commented on if I designed the Big Bang, the world would look differently, and maybe I wouldn't choose the central limit theorem to be true. My answer always is, like it or not, if I take the average of observations, it will start looking normally distributed. But you're right. Your concept of why you want that, the answer is, by taking the average of all these observations, am I losing information about the original distribution? And that's really what the answer is. If I have five numbers, and if I were to have graphed out what the distribution of those five numbers looked like, it would look more like the density. But once I take the average of them, I lose information about the shape of the original density. And it starts being that no matter what distribution I started with, when I take the average, I've lost all information about what the shape of that original density was, and the averages start looking like a normal distribution. So it really is Murphy's Law. It really is Murphy's Law that I'm losing information. But what is nice is that this means that whenever I do inference about means, I don't have to worry so much about what the distribution is. I can use the same technique no matter what distribution. Now, the log normal distribution is one in which if you take the logarithm of your data, it then appears normally distributed. And it's a highly skewed distribution. So this one I chose that is not all that skewed. The mean of this distribution is 12.18. The standard deviation is 15.97. We certainly see more skewed data than this in lots of our biomedical data, and lots of our liver enzymes or creatinine in renal disease or in PSA, we see data that's much more skewed than this. And in this case, you see that the mean of 5 is still pretty skewed. By the time we're down to 10, we still got a little bit too much skewedness. By the time we're to a sample size of 50, that skewness that we do see is of such low probability that it may not affect our inference. And by the time we're up to 40, you know, we're into the central 95% will be much like the central 95% of a normal distribution. The tails of the distribution, if I wanted to say 99.99%, that won't agree with the normal distribution. But the central part does. Of course, if I take something that is more highly skewed, so this is a log normal distribution that has a mean of 54.6, but its standard deviation is 400. Okay? And again, we see data like this in real life that has standard deviation that much more, that's that skewed. And what we see is sample size of 5 doesn't look all that normal. 10 doesn't look at all that normal. 20, still not quite normal enough. 40, still we're picking up that skewness. 80, 160, 320, 640, 1280, okay? The more skewed I make it, the larger the sample size before it starts looking like a good approximation. It will eventually. It's just depending upon how skewed your data is, it takes a longer time for it to look normal. Interestingly, just because it doesn't look all that normal doesn't mean that these methods that we're going to use to compare means are necessarily anti-conservative. That's what we start worrying about. Did we get our errors wrong? Did we quantify our precision too much? The truth is, skewed distributions affect our standard errors more than they affect the means. So the bias that creeps into the mean is less than how it blows up the standard deviation. So largely, it's a matter of precision. When we have extremely skewed data, there's usually a problem with the precision of our analysis more than the accuracy in terms of the statistical inference. But we'll be talking more about that as we go on. So questions on this? That's right. Yeah. Because, yeah, yeah. So when we are going to do our statistical inference, when we take our sample, we're going to use the sample mean. And then we're going to say, how well do we know what the sample mean is? And most times, we're going to use the normal distribution to make our confidence intervals, to put our precision on. I'm going to say, you know what my best estimate is that the average height of 4-year-olds is 49 inches. And my precision is, I am confident, that's jargon, I am confident that it's between 48.2 inches and 49.8 inches tall. And if I put that precision on it, I'm going to take that precision by assuming that my sample mean was normally distributed. And what I'm arguing here is it works. And it works because sample means are normally distributed as we get a large enough sample size.
And you're saying words for every.
As long as there is a variance. Everybody go home and write down the distribution that there is no variance. There are some. But they're pathologic, they're mathematical tricks that keep us amused, but that have no meaning in real life. But the idea is, this will work for, you know, a reasonable sample size. We do have to worry about it a little bit, but not much, as it turns out. So this, using the normal distribution to do our inference. There are other central limit theorems. We have them in particular for the typical situation that we really have, where our data are independent but not identically distributed. Yeah, usually we have males and females, and we're not assuming that they're all in the same distribution. Or in our FEV data set, we have them all different ages, all different heights, and we're assuming our data is not identically distributed. But we do have theorems that allow the central limit theorem in that case. We have them that in when we have correlated observations up to a limit. This is where the people in gene expression experiments are running up against the wall, because what they want to say is, well, yes, I only have 8 observations, but I have 20,000 genes. And I can get you more genes if you want. And said, no, we need more than 8 subjects. And so we can handle correlated observations as long as we're gaining more statistical information, but just adding in more and more correlated observations without any more independent data gets us into trouble. So these central limit theorems are hard to describe. We have things that if we transform our statistic, we know what to do. So there's lots of things we do. You will catch me talking about this by asymptotically we know this. I'm not going to go through all these details. Generally, the people who write the computer programs will get the formulas right. We'll count on that. But the idea is there are additional conditions beyond finite variance. For instance, when I am trying to do a comparison between males and females, and then I say, you know what? A sample size goes to infinity, I get a normal distribution. It's going to be correct. It doesn't work if I sample one male and an infinite number of females. I need to let both those sample sizes go to infinity. So little things like that. Sometimes we need to tell the computer programs to use special formulas as we run into these problems. Okay, so let's now apply this to actually testing the mean. And of course, I am well known among my department for just saying, you know, it's all just the t-test. That's the only thing we know how to do. But we do it well. And all we're doing is we're testing the means. Now, all of our more complicated statistics are generally testing means, but sometimes we first transformed it by some god-awful formula, and then we do the mean of it. So it's hidden from you. But we're really using this same inference. So let's start off with the simplest case, one sample. We'll talk about point estimates, confidence intervals, and hypothesis tests. So the mean is the most common parameter used as a basis for statistical inference. It tends to reflect a wide variety of differences between distributions. It's extremely sensitive to changes in the tail of the distribution. This is one of my colleagues just was writing up some document and changing that said, we need to be a little bit nicer as we send this document out. Because that's what makes them pay attention to us. My answer always is saying, I'm not trying to get my wording in there. I'm trying to get them to move their opinion closer to mine. And so I'd rather be the outlier and have somebody write the nice wording than me write the nice wording by caving to what they say. Well, this is the same thing. So these tails of the distribution will affect the mean more. And then the nice thing, the Statistician Full Employment Act says that because we always use the mean and we know the central limit theorem holds, we can do something. We know how to provide inference. Most often, we estimate the population mean with sample mean. The sample mean is always an unbiased estimate for the true mean, no matter what distribution you have. Okay, so I'll put on the little asterisk. So long as there really is a mean. Yeah, there's a distribution that has no mean, too, but that's a silly one. So this is always an unbiased estimate for the true mean. It's always a consistent estimate for the true mean. As the sample size increases to infinity, it will be the truth. So that first one is saying, on average, if I do replicated experiments and average the results of a whole bunch of experiments, it'll be the truth. The second one says, do one experiment but with an infinite sample size. It'll be the truth. Very often, it has less variability than any other estimate of the mean. So the idea here is that if I knew the true distribution of my data, I might use a screwy estimate of the mean. So if I knew my data were log normal, I would estimate the mean more precisely using some difficult formula rather than using the sample mean. And that other difficult formula would have smaller variability than the sample mean. But in every case, the sample mean will estimate the true mean, whereas that estimate that I'd come up with if I assumed log normal, if it weren't log normal, it wouldn't be estimating the mean anymore. So I get the robustness. I get an estimator that works all the time, no matter what the distribution is. And then for lots of different distributions, the normal distribution, the binomial distribution, the Poisson distribution, the exponential distribution, the sample mean is the most efficient estimator. The approximate sampling distribution for large n, x bar is approximately normal with mean equal to the mean of the population and variance equal to the variance of the population divided by your sample size. So what should we expect given that it's normally distributed? Well, if it's normally distributed, then our sample mean should be between the true mean and 1.645 times the standard error. The standard error is sigma over the square root of n. So it should be between the true mean plus or minus 1.645 times sigma over square root of n 90% of the time. It should be plus or minus 1.96 standard errors 95% of the time. And so usually what do we say? We say 2. So this plus or minus 2 standard errors should contain 95% of the sample means. 2.576, 99% of the time. What if I want it to be 100 times 1 minus alpha percent? Well, the notation that we use is we use z 1 minus alpha over 2. And that what we mean by that is the critical value that will provide that probability. Where do we come up with those numbers? Well, this is what I was talking about on Monday. It takes numerical integration, nowadays done with computer, long before done with graduate students. And it takes to do this, and they tabled it once in the back of a book. But now, we use data, we can use the norm command. Or it is called pnorm. Confidence intervals. A frequentist confidence interval answers this question. I got certain data. For what values of the population parameter would I have expected to get this data? Okay, it's more or less like saying an animal just walked by. It had four legs. For what kinds of animals would I expect to see an animal with four legs? And the answer is, of course, an awful lot of mammals and also horseflies that you pulled off two of the legs. Okay, I mean, you know, this is this concept. And so then, you know, what we're asking is, well, how often do you see horseflies with two legs pulled off? Well, not that often. So we're going to go ahead and stick with the mammals here. You know, and this is the sort of question that a confidence interval is asking. It's not saying probably what kind of animal is this. It's saying for what kind of animals would we have seen this data. How should you define typical? There's three approaches that we might use. We'd say it's typical if it's not too large. It's typical if it's not too small. Or if it's typical if it's not too large or too small. How should we define extreme? What proportion? What proportion is unusual? You know, what do people regard as an unusual event? You know, how many people in here won't talk on the telephone when a thunderstorm is happening? You know, and what sort of percent of people in here won't cross the street because there's a much higher chance they're going to be killed by a car than that, rather than talking on the telephone during a thunderstorm? You know, it's that what? How many people buy lottery tickets? And then how far do you have to drive to buy a lottery ticket before you stand a better chance of being killed in the car going to buy it than you do of winning the lottery? I mean, these are things. We're irrational on a lot of these things about what's a rare event versus not. But apparently the 11th commandment came out somewhere around 5% for a two-sided test, 2.5% for a one-sided test. It has something to do, I'm sure, with the number 1.96, which is nearly 2, and almost all statisticians can count to 2. So it turns out that this 2 standard errors lines up with this 2.5% or 5%, depending upon how you're defining typical up there. So a lower confidence bound, what a lower confidence bound is the mean that was so low, that anything lower than that, we shouldn't have gotten this data. And what do I mean by shouldn't have gotten this data? It would have been a really rare event to see this data. So the probability is less than alpha that we would have observed the sample mean that we observed if mu was mu L. So X bar, this has to be less than or equal to mu L plus Z1 minus alpha C1 over squared root. We reverse that and we say our lower bound, let's take X bar minus that critical value times sigma over the square root of n. And again, our interpretation, when I give you that lower bound, I say anything lower and we wouldn't have expected to see this data. That doesn't mean it's impossible. It just means that it would have been a rare event. Upper confidence bound, we just go the other way. Ultimately, we find the mean as we x bar plus our critical value times sigma over square root of n. That is the value of mean, the mean, such that x bar that we observed was relatively rare. And our confidence interval, which is what we use most often, is we use an interval. It's x bar plus or minus z1 minus alpha over 2, sigma over square root of n. Most often, that critical value that we will use will be 1.96, and it will be a 95% confidence interval. As we come to the t distribution to deal with the fact that sometimes we're estimating sigma and we know a better way to deal with that, we'll use something that the number is close to 2, but not 1.96 exactly. So that's this small sample adjustment. Almost always, we have to estimate the population standard deviation. With continuous data, we use the sample standard deviation, which we call S. So we just plug S in instead of sigma. And then we use critical values for the T distribution. It's related to the normal distribution. It just has slightly heavier tails. And we use heavier tails according to our sample size. So this is the correct thing to do if the data were truly normally distributed. We never have truly normally distributed data, but this behaves well in other settings. And so instead of using the Z critical value, we use the T critical value. Our software will do that for us automatically. So our software will find that correct critical value. Notice that it will use a different thing according to the sample size. So it will use a different distribution. And as n goes to infinity, that will look just like the critical value of the normal distribution. As n gets to be 2, this is a very wide distribution. So the T distribution, the degrees of freedom are related to the sample size. Usually it's the sample size minus the number of parameters that were used to estimate the mean. It's symmetric about 0, and heavier tails with decreasing degrees of freedom. 1 degree of freedom is the Cauchy distribution. This is one of those pathologic distributions. There is no mean. Infinite degrees of freedom is standard normal. These are lots of different T distributions. Certainly, if I draw them, you can't tell the difference between the T distribution and the normal distribution. But there is a slight difference in how heavy the tails are. If we look at the quantiles, as the degrees of freedom is infinite, we see that the 0.025 critical value is 1.96. If I only have 1 degree of freedom, it's 12.706. So you can see that with a small sample size, you're going to get a very wide confidence interval. In between, when does it start coming in close enough to 1.96 for you to just use the number 2? Well, certainly by 50. You're probably happy enough at 20. But again, the software we use will always make this adjustment. In Stata, we get the confidence interval for a population mean by typing CI, giving our variable, and then we tell it what level we want. Unfortunately, it does not believe that you ever want anything that's not an integral confidence interval. In my life, unfortunately, sometimes I need something like that. I need a very high value for multiple comparisons in clinical trials. But you can get this. The default is 95% confidence interval. If you have summary statistics from a paper, you can use CII, which means immediate confidence interval. You just give the sample size, the mean, and the standard deviation. And I'll note that as we get into the t-test come Monday, it will also give the 95% confidence. So we'll pick up here on Monday. Of course, the exam is on Friday.